This is VOA News. I'm Liz Pelka. Afghan officials are counting votes after Saturday's presidential election that was held amid repeated threats by the Taliban. Unofficial estimates indicate the voter turnout will be an historic low. Election officials say only about 20% of the country's more than 9 million eligible voters cast ballots. The insurgents did carry out some attacks, according to authorities, but were blocked from conducting any major violence. Hong Kong protests turned violent on Sunday in some of the most widespread violence in more than 3 months of anti-government unrest. Reuters' Emma McCarthy reports.
Proudly flying the Chinese flag, around 200 Hong Kongers from pro-Beijing groups rallied across the city ahead of Chinese National Day on Tuesday. Some demonstrators calling for the end of opposition protests which have gripped the city for months.
I'm proud as a Chinese. I'm proud living in Hong Kong.
Meantime, anti-Chinese protesters were flying flags from across the globe.
To give pressures upon the Beijing government not to carry them anymore.
But their march quickly descended into chaos, with some of the most violent scenes in more than 3 months of civil unrest. Protesters threw petrol bombs and bricks at government buildings. Riot police fired water cannon with blue dye to easily identify protesters, as well as rubber bullets and rounds of tear gas.
That was Reuters' Emma McCarthy. Thousands of Russians braved the cold rain to jam a central Moscow square as opposition groups sought to regain momentum following a summer of demonstrations that targeted both local elections and Russia's broader political system. The Sunday rally was the first major effort by liberal political groups and allied parties since elections earlier in the month. This is VOA News. Voting is underway in Austria's parliamentary election. Sunday's vote comes 4 months after a corruption scandal brought down ex-Chancellor Sebastian Kurz's coalition government. More than 6 million voters ages 16 and up are eligible to cast ballots in Sunday's election. Britain's Boris Johnson said Sunday that he will not resign, even if he fails to secure a withdrawal deal with the European Union before the end of October. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
As his Conservatives' annual conference begins in Manchester, the Prime Minister is seeking to rally his party behind his do-or-die message, that he will deliver Brexit by the end of October, with or without a deal.
Order!
But he's declined to explain how he will circumvent a law, passed by Parliament, that would force him to ask the EU for a delay to Brexit if he has not secured a withdrawal deal by the end of an EU summit on October the 17th and 18th.
Not a good start, Boris.
He's called that law the Surrender Act. Opposition lawmakers have said such language is stoking division in an already fractured country.
With many of us in this place subject to death threats and abuse every single day.
I have to say, Mr. Speaker, I've never heard such humbug in all my life.
Speaking on the Andrew Marr show on Sunday.
Including you.
I think I've been a model of restraint, but I think everybody should calm down.
That was Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Cameroon's Dialogue for Peace is set to begin Monday the 30th. Thousands of people affected by the separatist war have been on the streets in Bamenda calling on the government to be sincere as talks start. Esther Najomo is the coordinator of the Northwest-Southwest Women Task Force for Peace, saying they are asking President Paul Biya to release arrested English-speaking leaders as a sign he is serious about the dialogue.
We, the women, are saying that he can grant clemency or pardon to those arrested within the context of the Anglophone crisis and allow them to take part in the national dialogue so that we all, as one, forge ahead looking into the possible solutions for life to go back to normalcy in the two regions.
Reuters reports Cameroon has been gripped by violence since November 2016, when government forces crushed a movement of Anglophone teachers and lawyers protesting against their perceived social exclusion by the country's French-speaking majority. The protests turned into an insurgency of separatists seeking independence for the Anglophone Southwest and Northwest regions. At least 2,000 people have been killed. More international headlines for you on VOAnews.com. I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. And thanks to my friend and colleague Douglas Impuga for hosting the show while I was away on a special assignment.
We are not sure it's going to be Alain. This may be speculative in the sense that we haven't been notified. Mr. Shewore, who is even in the custody of the State Security Service, has not been notified as well.
A former Nigerian presidential candidate, Omoyele Sowore, faces a high court arraignment Monday.
If you dig down in terms of the evidence, you find that it's the government, it's the police that are, you know, fueling all the attacks, and the attacks are on the people who are being protesting. It's not the other way around. And not the people who are saying that they are the enemies of democracy in this country.
A Malawian political pressure group calls for fresh protests to pressure the chairperson of the Electoral Commission to step down.
Because of the way our salaries have eroded, you have to consider to cushion up. 3% is not enough. Why don't you add 6.5% on the 3%?
And public sector workers in Eswatini plan a second industrial strike action on Wednesday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian government has scheduled to arraign a former presidential candidate, Omoyele Sowore, before the Federal High Court in the capital Abuja Monday. Sowore reportedly faces 7 charges, including treasonable felony, money laundering and cyber crimes. The opposition leader, who is the publisher of Sahara Reporters, is accused of calling for a revolution through a protest, which was scheduled for August 5. The government contends that the revolution was aimed at toppling President Muhammadu Buhari's administration, an accusation the defense team sharply rejects. Femi Falana, leader of the former presidential candidate's defense team, tells me the government failed to inform his team about Monday's arraignment.
Well, apart from the report in the papers, we haven't been informed. Neither Mr. Sowore nor his lawyers have been informed about the proposed arraignment. And under our law, he's entitled to notice, and we're also entitled to notice. So we haven't been informed that the matter will come up tomorrow for arraignment.
So what are you going to do about it if you have not been officially
well,
informed?
Well, what is on ground is for the government to obey the order of the court that Mr. Sowore be released on bail for now. And that is very, very important. And no explanation has been offered, no explanation has been given as to why the order of the court cannot be obeyed. There is no way government can go to the same court to ask for any relief by way of arraignment without complying with the order of the court and the earlier order of the court that this man be released on bail. We have met all the bail conditions, and what is expected under the Nigerian law is that the order of the court be complied with in respect of anybody.
But some people are suggesting that Sowore is a national security threat to the peace and stability and to maintain the country's territorial integrity following his call for a revolution, which some people say is unacceptable.
No, in Nigeria currently, the threats to national security are coming from the terrorists and bandits, armed robbers and kidnappers. Right now, the federal government and the state government are negotiating with these criminal elements, giving them money and granting them amnesty. Now, Mr. Sowore only announced that he was going to have a protest against the security in the country, against unemployment, against lack of economic empowerment of the people, against lack of education for the majority of our people. Those were the demands under our law. Those demands cannot translate to an attempt to overthrow any government. The use of the word revolution is not a criminal offense in Nigeria. And I have challenged the government to cite to refer to any law in Nigeria that has criminalized the use of the word revolution. So no offense is committed by saying that I'm going to have a revolutionary protest. It's no offense.
Your client, Sowore, faces 7 counts of treasonable felony, money laundering, and cyber crimes. What do you make of these charges against him?
We do not want to go into the details of the charges now, but they are all bailable offenses. So that is where we are, and the court has already admitted him to bail. The duty of the government now is to comply with the orders of court in respect of Mr. Sowore.
Since you've not been officially notified, lawyers of Sowore have yet to be officially notified, but it's in the papers that he will be arraigned before court Monday. What is your next line of action?
Well, we are not going to take chances. We expect that they will bring him to court. If he's going to be arraigned, he cannot be arraigned in absentia. To that extent, we are going to be in court. The defense counsel, the members of the defense team will be in court.
When was the last time you met with your client?
Last week, about 2 weeks ago. We were not allowed to hold any consultation with him last week. I mean, since the court granted him to order his release, we have not been allowed to hold any form of consultation with him, you know, even to prepare his defense. He's now being held incommunicado without any legal justification.
What are your expectations? What are the expectations of the defense team of Sowore tomorrow?
Well, we are going to insist on compliance with the order of the court. Again, as I said, we are not sure it's going to be arraigned. This may be speculative in the sense that we haven't been notified. Mr. Sowore, who is even in the custody of the State Security Service, has not been notified as well. So we expect that, we're not going to be caught unawares. He's going to be in court. I mean, if they bring him to court, of course, we are going to appear for him.
Femi Falana is the leader of the former Nigerian presidential candidate's defense team. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Lagos. Thousands of people affected by the separatist war that has killed at least 2,000 people in the Cameroonian English-speaking regions have been on the streets calling on the government to be sincere about the dialogue for peace that is to begin September 30 so they can go back to their homes. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzaka reports from Bamenda, where 1,000 people have been in front of public buildings for 3 days.
Most of the 3,000 victims whom the government says have been in front of public buildings within the past 4 days have either lost loved ones or seen their property torched. Others who were wounded in the war say they have not had access to health care. 27-year-old vegetable retailer Petra Banin, who fled from the northwestern village of Kar, says her business was ruined after her husband was killed and her 2 sons abducted several times by separatist fighters.
I am a debtor in Bamenda. I don't know where to take money. I paid a ransom and they're threatening to take my son. My son cannot go to school. So I'm praying that our president, Kobia, he make a wave to solve this problem.
Esther Njomo, coordinator of the Northwest-Southwest Women Task Force for Peace, says they are asking Bia to release arrested English-speaking leaders as a sign he is serious about the dialogue.
We, the women, are saying that he can grant clemency or pardon to those arrested within the context of the Anglophone crisis and allow them to take part in the national dialogue so that we all, as one, forge ahead looking into the possible solutions for life to go back to normalcy in the two regions.
Njomo was referring to separatist leader Ayuk Tabe Julius and 10 of his collaborators who were given life jail sentences by a military tribunal in Yaoundé that said it had found them guilty of charges including secession and terrorism. When Bia called for the dialogue, he said he would allow justice to take its course concerning the arrested leaders, but that U.S. and Europe-based separatist leaders were invited to take part. They turned down the invitation unless the dialogue is held outside Cameroon with non-Cameroonians as mediators because they are wanted for the same crimes for which their peers in Cameroon were given life sentences. George Ewane, spokesperson of the National Dialogue, says people should be assured the government is sincere about the dialogue and will do everything it can for peace to return.
The major national dialogue will address squarely the reconstruction of the affected areas, the return to civil life, and the reintegration of ex-demobilized combatants. Every conscious and peace-loving Cameroonian who wants children to go back to school, who hates bloodshed, maiming, kidnapping, rape, must do everything to see us back again with love and fraternity.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports that the separatist war has forced more than 530,000 people to flee their homes since the conflict erupted in late 2017. Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
The Malawian Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, is calling for fresh protests beginning October 1 to 4 to pressure the chairperson for the Electoral Commission to resign. The political pressure group is also demanding an independent investigation and prosecution of the perpetrators it blames for attacking the protesters. The demand came after the group's recent protest in the commercial capital Blantyre turned violent. For more on the upcoming protests, I reach Gift Trappens, Vice President of HRDC.
We are organizing another series of demonstrations, but this one we are going to do it in Lilongwe, the capital city. I think we are doing this on two reasons. The first reason is that we try to organize a demonstration in Blantyre where we followed the legal procedures, but to our surprise, our protesters were attacked. Our leaders were attacked by the ruling party followers in full view of the police. So our demonstration coming this coming week, from Tuesday to Friday, we are demanding for the arrest of those people who wanted to kill some of our members. That's one demand that we want to put, apart from the demand that we have always demanded for the resignation of Dr. Jenny Ansah, the Malawi Electoral Commission chairperson.
Why would you put your supporters' life in danger by organizing yet another series of demonstrations when you just say that you were attacked?
I think that's why we are doing, because it's not putting the lives of Malawians in danger, but we want those people who are, attacking people who are demonstrating peacefully, who are following the law, should be taken to task. Our democracy is under attack, so we cannot be spectators of our own democracy. So we want to protect our democracy so that the law should apply equally to anyone who is breaking the law. What we have seen is that even the police were shielding the ruling party forward. This is the impunity that we want to fight. We are not going to be spectators of these ills, of those people who want to oppress Malawi, those people who want to curtail our democracy.
Do you have proof of this allegation you are making that forces or supporters of the government were behind the attacks on supporters of HRDC that went to demonstrations?
It was very clear. We have evidence, we have videos, people took videos. And people were, gone in their party cross. So they cannot deny that. I mean, we have clear evidence, and we don't even need to investigate that. Because the police tear gas to assault our supporters, our demonstrators, but also they shielded those people who did not even seek authorized authorization or who did not notify the city authorities that they want to demonstrate. They ended up demonstrating with them. So this is the impunity that we are saying that enough is enough.
You know, anybody at all or criminals can put on paraphernalia of the ruling party just to create trouble in the country because of your demonstrations. So do you think that is proof enough? And have you engaged the authorities to investigate to find out the real perpetrators to be punished according to law?
We have our member who is the regional chair who was beaten and he was about to be killed. He had to be rescued by our wishes. So this is not a new thing. And they have also debated it in Parliament where
that the government is a denier of these atrocities that we are committed to fellow Malawians. After the accident, that even the police take us a hospital and we lost one child. This is more carelessness of policy. And these are the issues that we want the government to take seriously. It's at all we want to engage Ripper and stakeholders. We are not running away from engagement, but we have a government that knows it wants to be engaged.
Some people are saying that leaders of HRDC should be held accountable for these attacks because you are organizing these demonstrations that appear to turn violent.
That is not true. These violence are being fostered by the ruling party. And a typical example is the one that Floyd Blunt last week. They should not push the burden to those people who are very innocent, who are not armed. And if you look at all this violence that have happened, you want to blame the demonstrators. But if you dig down in terms of the evidence, you find that it's the government, it's the police that are, you know, fueling all the attacks. And the attacks are on the people who have been protesting. It's not the other way around. And those people who are saying that they are the enemies of democracy in this country.
Gift Trappens is the vice president of the Malawian HRDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Public sector workers in the southern African kingdom of Eswatini plan on a second industrial strike action on Wednesday. The strike organizers say it would seek to pressure the administration to increase the salary of the workers. It follows a dispute with the government over a pay increase to cover the sharp rise in the cost of living. Meanwhile, a similar strike last Wednesday turned violent following clashes between the police and the workers. Local media reports say the police fired rubber bullets and tear gas, injuring 15 during the strike. To learn more about the strikers' demands, I reach Thulani Klachwayu, Secretary General for the Eswatini Public Servants and Allied Workers Union.
Just towards the end of the March, we were delivering petitions around the senior government officers in Mbabane, which is the capital city. And then we had delivered all the petitions. Just after delivering the petition at the Prime Minister's office, when we were marching back to our assembly point, then the police started the violence by walking into the crowds of the protesters, infuriated the protesters, and they started pushing the police out of the crowd. And then the police began shooting. So the violence started like that by the police provoking the workers. And the reason why we are embarking on another strike on Wednesday, it is because the public sector unions had revised their offers to government. And they've even offered government to stagger the demand, which is now it is at 9.5% for the year of 2017-2018 and 2018-2019. So government doesn't want to give in.
Supporters of the government are saying you are not negotiating in good faith. You are embarking on a strike when you know you can engage the government to address some of your concerns.
That is not true, because just after the demonstration which was held in Mbabane, on Thursday, we did meet with government through the CIMAC, which is the mediation process. And it was the mediator, government, and the public sector union. We were even made to show affordability. What we said, if government does not have the money, the most appropriate solution out of this case is to cut or drop the income tax, which is pay as you earn. And government didn't even take that offer, because the tax, she is deducting the tax from our salary. We say drop the taxation either by 5%. You won't need to go and ask for money somewhere. It is the money you are deducting from me that you are returning back to me. They haven't even considered that option. We are negotiating in good faith. We have demonstrated on many occasions where they will get the money from, but they do not want to listen to us.
But if the government has told you there is no money and that you should consider your demands when revenue improves, then some of your concerns could be addressed. Why don't you think this is reasonable?
Even then, after she has said she thinks that things will be better on the year 2020, government is only offering 3% for the year 2020-21. We are saying what is going to happen to the past 3 years when there was no caller. You have to reimburse us for that. And because of the way our salaries have eroded, you have to consider to cushion us. 3% is not enough. Why don't you add 6.5% on the 3%? And you even have the privilege to stagger. You do not have to pay us the whole 9.5%. You can stagger it according to your affordability. So those are the flexibilities and the options we have given government. She does not want to consider any and maintains that I will give you only 3%. Whether she's going to backdate it or it is going to be staggered, what else will happen? Because for 2017 to 2018, it is 0% for the worker. For 2018 to 2019, it is 0% for the workers. And even this year, to 2020, it is 0% to the workers. Our salaries have been eroded by inflation plus or minus 20% of its affordability.
But aren't you going to put the life of your supporters or the public sector workers in danger since the first one that was organized turned violent? Don't you think this could equally turn violent?
Well, even the previous demonstration, as I said before, the violence started just after we've completed the whole demonstration. It started at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And the reason why, it is because the Public Order Act, it states clear that during the marches, the police officers should be 100 meters away from the march. What they do, they then go and wear private clothes and come into the crowd and provoke the workers. Some of them are easily identified as police. And then the crowds push them out because they have seen that. It is not us that provoke the police in order to bring violence to ourselves.
Tulani Tlatswayo is the Secretary General for the Eswatini Public Servant and Allied Workers Union. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. A UN human rights expert warns a host of natural and man-made disasters is impeding Somalia's efforts to stabilize the country and improve conditions for its population. For viewing, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva, where the UN Human Rights Council examined the expert's report this past week.
This is the independent expert's last report to the council before his mandate expires. Bahame Nyandunga says a number of changes have taken place in Somalia over the past 6 years, many for the better. He says there has been considerable progress in the security, political, socioeconomic, and human rights situation in the country. Unfortunately, he says, during that period, the conflict with the militant Al-Shabaab group has continued. He says the clampdown on freedom of expression and other rights and the failure to hold perpetrators of crimes accountable have continued.
Somalia has suffered grave human rights violations, in particular the endemic loss of lives due to improvised terrorist bombs by Al-Shabaab, inter-clan violence, and the absence of the rule of law. Violations of the rights of women through conflict-related gender-based violence and other sexual offenses such as rape. Violations of children's rights, including abduction and forced recruitment by Al-Shabaab.
Besides the man-made disasters, Nyandunga notes Somalia has had to contend with climatic and natural disasters, which have displaced 2.6 million people. He says climate change has exacerbated the competition for pastures and water, which are critical for pastoralism in Somalia.
Access to water is a fundamental human right. Addressing the problem of water scarcity will contribute significantly to the peace and reconciliation among clans because it has been identified as one of the problems creating inter-clan conflicts.
Tanzanian human rights attorney Nyandunga urges the international community to continue its assistance to Somalia. He says helping the government strengthen its institutions will boost the probability of the country one day achieving the peace, security, and stability it needs and deserves. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, UN agencies are rushing to provide aid to hundreds of thousands of people affected by severe flooding in Niger. The heavy rains, which began in June, have killed 57 people and affected 211,000. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Niger is facing multiple emergencies. The floods are just adding to the crises already stretching the capacity of the government and humanitarian agencies to respond. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the situation took a dramatic turn for the worse the last week of August. That was when water levels of the Niger Basin reached flood stage, and overflow from dams in neighboring Burkina Faso and Mali contributed to the surging waters. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the last time the Niger Basin reached this level was in 2012.
At that time, the floods left dozens of dead and affected nearly 500,000 people. Each year, there has been an upward trend in how many people are affected by these seasonal rains. We have seen a doubling of the number of people affected since 2015, as well as increasing material damage, including destruction of crops and loss of livestock.
The hardest hit regions are Zinder, Maradi, and Agadez. The UN reports more than 16,000 houses have been damaged, rendering tens of thousands of people homeless. The UN Children's Fund says an estimated 123,000 children are directly affected by the floods. Spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says children are the most vulnerable to respiratory infections, waterborne diseases, and a host of other problems.
The children in Niger face malnutrition, recurrent disease, epidemics and outbreaks, cyclical floods, drought, and displacement. This, of course, is exacerbated by the instability in neighboring countries. We have now an influx of thousands of refugees, returnees, and migrants, all of whom are in need of basic social services for survival.
The UN cites priority needs at shelter, non-food items, food, water, sanitation, and hygiene supplies. Humanitarian agencies warn they are having difficulty meeting the urgent needs because of serious underfunding. For instance, OCHA says it only has received 37% of its $380 million appeal. It says that is not enough to care for the 2.3 million people in need of aid in Niger. Half of them children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Ethiopia's Kenenisha Bekele fell just 2 seconds short of the world marathon record as he won in Berlin in 2 hours, 1 minute, 41 seconds. The 37-year-old former Olympic and world 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters champion missed out on Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge's 2 hours, 1 minute and 39 seconds set in the same race last year. Bekele's run is the second fastest marathon in history. Kipchoge was absent as he prepares for his sub-2-hour marathon attempt in Vienna on October 12th. Berhanu Legese finished second behind Bekele in the third fastest time in history, with Cissé Lema a further 48 seconds behind to complete an Ethiopian clean sweep. Ashte Bekele won the women's race in 2 hours, 20 minutes and 14 seconds, beating fellow Ethiopian Mare Dibaba by 8 seconds in a sprint finish. And at the World Athletics Championships Doha 2019, Sifan Hassan of the Netherlands took everything the top Kenyan and Ethiopians could throw at her and withstood it all to win her first global outdoor gold in what was only her second 10,000 meters race on Saturday. Hassan, who earlier this season broke a world mile record that was almost 23 years old before winning the IAAF Diamond League titles over 1,500 meters and 5,000 meters, won in a world-leading 30-17.62. Hassan only took the lead at the bell, holding off a massive sustained effort from Ethiopia's 21-year-old Letesenebet Gide, who finished in a personal best of 30-21.23, with bronze going to Kenya's Agnes Tirop in a personal best of 30-25.20. The women's 10,000 meters was the fast track final of the night, ahead of the men's 100 meters, won by Christian Coleman of the United States in 9.76 seconds. He bettered his own world leading mark by 0.05 as he finished ahead of 37-year-old compatriot Justin Gatlin, who clocked 9.89, and Canada's Olympic bronze medalist Andre de Grasse, who took bronze in a personal best of 9.90. The semifinals of the mixed 4x400 meters produced a world record as the United States quartet of Tara Richard, Jessica Bird, Jasmine Blocker, and Obi Ibokwe reached Sunday's final in 3:12.42. Jamaica was second fastest qualifiers in a national record of 3:12.73, ahead of Bahrain's team that included world 400 meters.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, yeah, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the current 74th session of the General Assembly, the annual general debate commenced last week. Those African heads of state that have spoken have all called for the reform of the Security Council. When it came to the time of the President of Sierra Leone, His Excellency Julius Maada Bio, the coordinator of Africa's position on the Security Council, he made a bold, impressive, and comprehensive case for Africa in terms of Security Council reform. In that regard, he affirmed that Africa needs two permanent seats, additional two non-permanent seats, and that the permanent seats should have all the responsibilities and attributes as those being held by the current five permanent members of the organization. We are now approaching 25 years since the commencement of serious discussions about the reform of the Security Council in the United Nations. And for those who may wonder why is it taking so long, let me offer a brief background. The serious discussions began in 1996 when three Western permanent members of the Council, the United Kingdom, France, and the United States, made clear that they would like to give permanent seats to Germany and Japan. Members of the non-aligned group said, yes, there are no objection to this state, but what about Africa? What about Latin America, and what about Asia? And this was when there was an additional three permanent seats offered for discussion. Subsequently, in 1997, at the OAU summit in Zimbabwe, the Africans reaffirmed the position but said that they would wish to have two permanent seats instead of one. This matter was put before the group in New York, and then some permanent members said that they could not allow the new permanent members to have the same rights as the old permanent members, meaning the right of veto. This was dismissed out of hand because there is no mention in the charter about veto. What we call the right of veto arises out of the fact that the charter says decisions of the council must have the concurrent votes of the permanent members. So it is the permanency that gives you what we now call the right of veto. Then with regards to the expansion of non-permanent members, these same permanent members said the council will become too large, and it will be difficult to take decisions. That's where the impasse stays, and nothing much has really changed. Then what should the Africans do to change situation? It is my judgment, known as I know the Security Council, having worked there for 30 years, it is necessary for the Africans to mobilize the non-aligned group and to make sure that they devise a plan that will make it difficult for these few permanent members who are raising obstacles to make it difficult for them also to get to what they want. You need 9 votes to get a decision of the council, and they the non-permanent members can make that possible. They can have their own veto to deny those permanent members the 9 votes that they required. What we are now seeing is the guardrails supplied by the charter is being ignored by these permanent members, and they're going their own way. So unless the Africans and the non-aligned do their job very well, the Security Council will become what it is today, a forum that is used mostly to discuss African problems and take decisions on African issues, but are not willing to deal with the issues of the Charter, the maintenance of international peace and security. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Salu, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, around a flowering tree, there are many insects. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Milton.